Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast, In-State Trust Beneficiaries and State Taxes Edition. I'm your host, Bridget Flaherty. On June 21st, 2019, the Supreme Court decided North Carolina Department of Revenue versus the Kimberly Rice Kaysner 1992 Family Trust, a case considering the ability of states to tax trust income for in-state beneficiaries even when these beneficiaries do not receive any distributions. About 30 years ago, Joseph Lee Rice II formed a trust for the benefit of his children and their families. The trust was formed in New York State and governed by New York law, as well as administered by a trustee who is a New York resident. Kimberly Rice Kaysner moved to North Carolina in 1997 and claimed residency from 2005 to 2008. After the move, the trustee opted to divide Rice's initial trust into three separate subtrusts, while still maintaining control of all three trusts. The trust at issue in this case is the Kimberly Rice Kaysner 1992 Family Trust, the Kaysner Trust, which North Carolina sought to tax on the grounds that it, quote, is for the benefit of North Carolina residents. North Carolina taxed the trust for tax years 2005 to 2008, levying a bill of more than $1.3 million. The trustee paid the tax under protest and sued North Carolina in state court, arguing that the tax as applied to the Kaysner Trust violates the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Kaysner had received no income from the trust during the years in question. The trust was governed by New York law, and the trustee did not live in North Carolina. The state courts ruled in favor of Kaysner, and the state of North Carolina obtained a grant of certiorari. In a unanimous decision, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed the judgment of the Supreme Court of North Carolina. In an opinion delivered by Justice Sotomayor, the court held that the presence of in-state beneficiaries alone does not empower a state to tax trust income that has not been distributed to the beneficiaries, where the beneficiaries have no right to demand the income and are uncertain to receive it. Justice Alito filed a concurring opinion, joined by the Chief Justice and Justice Gorsuch. And now, to discuss the case, we have John Yurick, Senior Counsel for Litigation at the U.S. Chamber Litigation Center.
So at first blush, this case might seem pretty boring. A constitutional case, yes, but ultimately just a case about tax law, which is a subject many lawyers deliberately try to avoid, both during and after law school. But if that's your first impression of the case, think again. Because if you dig just a little deeper into this case, beyond the specific question presented, it's actually about so much more than just the taxation of an out-of-state trust. It is fundamentally about choice of law and federalism. So most constitutional debates over federalism involve what's known as vertical federalism, which is the allocation of power between the federal government and the states. But this case, by contrast, is about horizontal federalism, the allocation of power among the 50 states. In other words, Kaysner concerns the territorial bounds of each state's authority and the constitutional limits on a state's power to reach people and property beyond its borders. Before we get deeper into the case, however, I must offer a brief disclaimer. So, although I work as senior counsel for the U.S. Chamber Litigation Center, my remarks reflect my personal views alone about Kaysner and the surrounding issues. My remarks don't necessarily reflect the views of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Lit Center, or their members. But with that out of the way, let's dive into the case. For starters, what, after all, does taxation of out-of-state trusts have anything to do with due process? And that's a great question, and answering it requires a bit of history. So during the late 19th and early 20th century era of a case known as Pennoyer versus Neff, which is a case pretty much every first-year law student studies in civil procedure, during that time, the Supreme Court rigidly enforced the territorial limits of state power through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, among other constitutional provisions. Before the founding, these territorial limits, indeed the entire broader subject of choice of law, were a matter of unwritten international law known as the Law of Nations. And legal scholars still debate whether and to what extent the original Constitution incorporated the territorial limits on state power either explicitly, perhaps through the Dormant Commerce Clause or Full Faith and Credit Clause, or otherwise implicitly through just the Constitution's broader federalist structure. Regardless, once the 14th Amendment was ratified, though, in 1868, the Due Process Clause offered the Supreme Court a new hook for constitutionalizing these territorial limits on state power. And so generally speaking, the Pernoyer-era Supreme Court understood the newly ratified Due Process Clause to prohibit states from regulating, taxing, or asserting judicial power over people and property physically outside their territory. There were definitely exceptions, and courts employed a pretty complicated and often disputed set of rules for determining whether a purported target of state power was present in the state or whether a transaction occurred there for constitutional purposes. But while not always clear, the 19th century, early 20th century territorial analysis was pretty formalistic. So for the most part, state power was territorially bounded. And as with the antebellum Constitution, legal scholars likewise debate whether the original meaning of the Due Process Clause in the 14th Amendment fairly encompasses the territorial limits on state power. Some scholars argue that constitutionalizing these limits through due process was just another example of the Supreme Court's, you know, Lochner-style economic substantive due process, and the Lochner era and the Pernoyer era largely overlap. But that substantive due process characterization might be wrong, at least for the territorial limits on state court personal jurisdiction. And personal jurisdiction seems much more procedural in any event. And the Lochnerism charge just might not trouble you anyway if you're a fan of Lochnerism and more robust judicial review of economic liberty. But if this originalist debate intrigues you, the subject of choice of law and extraterritoriality in the Constitution is a very deep one, and there's a massive historical originalist literature out there. But if this debate intrigues you, I especially recommend a brilliant article by Professor Stephen Sachs at Duke called Pernoyer Was Right. It's published in the Texas Law Review, I believe, in 2017. And Professor Sachs makes a really interesting argument that the way the unwritten international law interacts with the new Due Process Clause effectively constitutionalizes the limits on state court personal jurisdiction. And I think in an article that I'm working on right now in the early stages, shameless plug here, but not coming anytime very soon, I think you might be able to use Professor Sachs' argument and make a similar argument for the substantive limits on state power. But regardless, just as the Supreme Court eventually retreated from economic substantive due process during the New Deal era, it also retreated from sort of strict enforcement of the territorial limits on state power. And so by the mid-20th century, rigid formalism of the old era gave way to a more flexible, pragmatic analysis. And so for better or worse, the modern Supreme Court has largely abandoned the strict territorialism of the Pernoyer era. And now, when evaluating the geographic scope of state judicial or legislative power, including the power to tax, which is at issue in this case, the court employs a more flexible minimum contacts test. Instead of focusing on the fundamental limits on state sovereignty, this minimum contacts analysis focuses on the reasonableness of the state government's action. And the most famous example of the modern pragmatic approach is the Supreme Court's 1945 opinion in International Shoe versus Washington, which concerns the constitutional limits on state court personal jurisdiction over out-of-state defendants. International Shoe held that state courts may exercise personal jurisdiction over out-of-staters only if the defendant has certain minimum contacts with the state such that asserting power over them does not offend traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. And so in Kastner, Justice Sotomayor clarified, really reaffirmed, that this same minimum contacts approach applies when evaluating a state's power to tax under the Due Process Clause. And so at a very high level of generality, the due process minimum contacts analysis, the modern analysis, is basically the same for all aspects of state power, whether it's a state's legislative power to regulate behavior, sometimes referred to as its legislative jurisdiction, whether it's its power to tax income or property, sometimes called the jurisdiction to tax, or whether it's judicial power to hail people involuntarily into its courts and conclusively adjudicate their rights, sometimes called adjudicative jurisdiction or more commonly just personal jurisdiction. For all three of these assertions of state power, The minimum context test asks whether an individual's connections with a state are substantial enough to legitimate the state's exercise of coercive power over them. And to be sure, contexts that are enough to support one sort of state power over an individual, say a legislature's jurisdiction to regulate, don't necessarily support another power over the same person, say jurisdiction to tax or judicial jurisdiction to adjudicate. But the due process framework is generally the same. In its modern cases, the Supreme Court often frames the due process clause's minimum context requirement less as about, like I said, the fundamental limits on sovereignty, but more as about serving concerns about notice and fair warning to litigants and regulated parties. Requiring minimum context, the theory goes, ensures that people targeted by a state's power can fairly expect to be regulated or taxed by the state or otherwise be hailed into court there. And then this notice, this advance notice, allows the targets of state regulation or state power to, at least in theory, adjust their behavior in advance of the state's assertion of power. State taxation certainly implicates the need for fair notice, but it also raises another unique concern, the unjustified confiscation of property. Taxation is an exception to the constitutional rule against taking private property without just compensation. Taxes are obviously necessary to run the government, and we all benefit from having a government. So again, at least theoretically, we get something in return for our taxes. This is the basic social contract. But as a state's connection to out-of-state taxpayers gets weaker, the taxes on these out-of-staters start to look less like one side of the social contract of sort of an exchange, and more like outright confiscation, with the government giving little, if anything, in return. So the modern due process test for a state's jurisdiction to tax thus also reflects this additional unique concern about confiscation in addition to the general concerns about fair notice. And the Supreme Court accordingly applies a two-step analysis to decide if a state tax satisfies the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. And first, the taxing state must have a sufficient connection to the person, property, or transaction that it seeks to tax. And this is the basic minimum context requirement that ensures fair notice. But second, the income or property taxed by the state must be rationally related to values connected with the taxing state. And this additional requirement ensures that the amount of the state tax is not completely disproportionate to the government benefits that the taxpayer receives in exchange. Now, Kaestner is only about the first requirement, the minimum context test, and how that test applies to the taxation of out-of-state trust income. But before we get to that specific question, and I promise that we'll get there, you need some general background on trusts, but just the basics. A trust is technically not a distinct legal entity like a corporation. It is not an artificial legal person. On the contrary, a trust is merely a fiduciary relationship between multiple people. A trust is created when one person, known as the settlor or grantor, transfers property to a third party, the trustee, to administer for the benefit of another party, the beneficiary. The trustee legally owns the property throughout the relationship, and also owns any income generated from it, while the beneficiary has only an equitable interest in that property and that income. But the trustee nevertheless has a fiduciary duty to manage the property for the beneficiary's benefit, hence the term beneficiary, that's what the name suggests, subject to, importantly, any directions and restrictions that the settlor provides at the outset of the trust's creation. And those restrictions from the settlor, sometimes put in a trust agreement, actually turn out to be key to the Supreme Court's analysis in Kaestner. And so now, with that historical and legal background, you can now understand the specific question presented in Kaestner. And that question is this: does the Due Process Clause permit a state to tax the undistributed income of a trust simply because one of the trust's beneficiaries lives within the state? So in other words, does a beneficiary's residence alone give the trust, not the beneficiary, the trust, a constitutionally sufficient connection with the state to allow the state to tax the trust's out-of-state income? And in a unanimous opinion by Justice Sotomayor, the Supreme Court said no, meaning that North Carolina cannot tax the Kaestner Family Trust, consistent with the Constitution. And this outcome is largely consistent with what court watchers' expectations were after oral argument. But the court's opinion was actually quite narrow. Justice Sotomayor took great pains to repeatedly emphasize that the court's due process analysis was limited to this specific trust with its somewhat unique characteristics and conditions, which I'll get into. And Justice Sotomayor also expressly noted in several places that the court was not deciding certain issues. The court specifically held that the presence of in-state beneficiaries alone does not empower a state to tax trust income that has not been distributed to the beneficiaries, where the beneficiaries have no right to demand that income and are uncertain ever to receive it. And that last part is key. Justice Sotomayor explained that the court analyzes the constitutionality of state trust taxes by examining the relationship between the relevant trust constituent, either the settlor, trustee, or beneficiary, and the trust assets that the state seeks to tax. Under this approach, and consistent with the court's due process precedents, she explained, various contacts do allow a state to tax out-of-state trust income. States can tax out-of-state trust income actually distributed to in-state residents. They can tax trust income based on the trustee's in-state residence. And they can tax trust income if the trust is actually administered within the state. But this case is different, Justice Sotomayor reasoned. The Kastner Trust made no distributions to any North Carolina resident during the relevant tax years. The trustee resided out of state and held no North Carolina investments. The trust was administered out of the state, and the settlor did not even live in North Carolina. The Kastner Trust's only connection with North Carolina is that some of the beneficiaries live there. In the specific context of beneficiary contacts, Justice Sotomayor explained, the due process analysis focuses on the extent of the in-state beneficiary's right to control, possess, enjoy, or receive trust assets. The justice noted, however, that the court's precedents also employ a similar analysis for state taxes premised on the residency of settlors and trustees, also focusing on their ownership, control, and rights to trust assets. But because each trust constituent fulfills different functions in the creation and continuation of the trust, Justice Sotomayor explained, the specific features of that relationship sufficient to sustain a tax may vary, depending on whether the resident is a settlor, beneficiary, or trustee. Importantly, though, the court explicitly refused to reach the Kastner Trust's broader argument that the trustees' contacts alone, and not the beneficiaries, determine the state's power over the trust overall, and for whatever exercises state power. The parties hotly disputed whether this proposition follows from one of the court's major personal jurisdiction precedents, a case known as Hansen versus Denkla, decided in 1958, but the court chose not to get into the proper reading of that case. And that choice not to clarify or reaffirm the proper reading of Hansen versus Denkla significantly limits Kastner's broader implications, and it may have also prompted Justice Alito's separate concurrence, joined by the Chief Justice and Justice Gorsuch. And the point of Justice Alito's concurrence was he said basically the majority opinion, which all three of these concurring justices joined in full, the majority opinion, Justice Alito says, is appropriately narrow, but I'm writing just to make it very clear that any of the issues that we've tabled here or not specifically taken a position on does not imply that any of our precedents on those issues are open for reconsideration. What I take away from the Justice Alito concurrence is that Justice Alito and these two other concurring justices, the Chief and Justice Gorsuch, may have regarded some of those tabled issues as actually having been decided by prior precedent, and they didn't want the fact that the court didn't expressly opine on those issues to at all suggest that they were necessarily open, undecided issues. So in any event, assuming without deciding that at least sometimes a state may tax an out-of-state trust based on the in-state residence of a beneficiary, Justice Sotomayor explained that the Due Process Clause requires that the resident have some degree of possession, control, or enjoyment of the trust property or otherwise a right to receive that property in the future before the state can tax the asset. Otherwise, she said, the state's relationship to the object of its tax is too attenuated to create the minimum connection that the Constitution requires. But even further limiting Kastner's significance, however, the court refused to specify precisely what degree or what type of possession, control, or enjoyment of trust assets or a future right to trust assets would be sufficient to support a state's taxation. The court simply held that the Kaestner Trust beneficiaries specifically do not have the requisite relationship with the trust property to justify North Carolina's taxation. And the court explained a few reasons for that conclusion. So first, as discussed, the beneficiaries never received any income from the trust during the relevant tax years. But they also had no right to demand trust income or otherwise control, possess, or enjoy the trust assets because the trust agreement, and this goes back to those conditions that I mentioned that the settlor can put on the trust agreement gave the trustee absolute discretion over investment decisions and the distribution of trust assets. And so the court explained this absolute discretion deprived the beneficiaries of any entitlement to demand distributions or to direct the use of the trust assets in their favor. And likewise, the beneficiaries could also not count on necessarily receiving any distributions from the trust in the future. And so the North Carolina beneficiaries' interests in the trust assets were completely contingent on the exercise of the trustee's discretion, which was significant under the trust agreement, total, really, under the trust agreement. And so for that reason, North Carolina's connection to the trust assets were very, very weak and constitutionally insufficient. So what are the broader implications of Kaestner? Well, honestly, for some of the reasons I've discussed, maybe not so much, actually, kind of surprisingly. The court presumably took this case because there was a split of authority among courts over whether or not a state could tax out-of-state trust assets based on a beneficiary's in-state residence. And the court likely was looking to resolve the split and likely provide some guidance to the states. But it ended up really not providing all that much guidance at all. And like I said, Justice Sotomayor really went out of her way to emphasize the narrowness of the court's ruling, that it was limited to the specific facts presented, she said. She also went on to reiterate that the court did not imply approval or disapproval of trust taxes that are premised on the residence of beneficiaries whose relationship to trust assets differs from that of the beneficiaries here. And so the court assured readers that the opinion did not address state tax laws that consider the in-state residency of a beneficiary as one of a combination of factors in the tax law analysis. The court expressly offered no opinion whatsoever on the validity of those type of tax laws. And so the court promised that its decision should only invalidate the tax laws of a small handful of states that rely on beneficiary residence as a sole basis for trust taxation, regardless of whether the beneficiary is certain to receive trust assets in the future. And so given that the court itself is saying our decision only really calls into question the laws of a few states, and the court left all these things open about, well, beneficiary residence plus some other factors might change the analysis, or some unspecified degree of control or right to the trust assets might change the analysis, not really sure how much guidance the court actually provided to states and potential taxpayers. But there are some other notable aspects of the court's opinion that may have important implications. So one is Justice Sotomayor's analysis heavily relied on trust taxation cases from, surprisingly, the Pennoyer era. And there was a big debate among the parties about the continued relevance of those Pennoyer era trust cases after International Shoe and once we entered the modern era of analysis about the territorial limits of state power. And so North Carolina insisted that those Pennoyer era early 20th century cases were no longer good law under the more flexible modern approach of International Shoe. But the court disagreed, or at least in part disagreed. The court said that the relevant aspects of those cases, specifically their focus on the beneficiary's possession, control, and the right to receive trust property in the future, remained consistent with the modern pragmatic approach reflected in International Shoe. So the court didn't say everything about those cases is still good law, but more or less the court reaffirmed that those holdings are reconcilable with the modern pragmatic approach in International Shoe and emphasized that the key portions of its analysis in those cases also survive. So this is actually quite important for litigants because it means that they can, to at least some extent, still rely on those older Pennoyer era cases. The trick will be to reconcile them and their holdings and as much of the analysis as possible with the modern International Shoe framework, but they're not categorically off limits. a second and final significant aspect of the court's decision is that it turned away the policy concerns that North Carolina raised. So North Carolina argued that adopting the trust's position would lead to opportunistic gaming of state tax systems, basically a loophole by allowing beneficiaries and trustees to delay trust distributions until a beneficiary moves to a lower tax state. And in North Carolina's brief, they talked about other ways that if the state were to lose, that trusts could game the tax system. And this exchange really between the parties on this policy issue is actually a fascinating example of effective advocacy, because the respondents, the trust, came back and said, no, that might happen to some extent, but what the state calls a tax loophole, we call federalism. And that's really powerful. I found that a really interesting exchange and a really great example of powerful advocacy. And the court more or less agreed with the trust and basically said, look, the court significantly downplayed the risk of this sort of gaming behavior, largely because of all the ways that it emphasized that the holding was very narrow. But in any event, the court didn't seem overly troubled with the potential that trusts could sort of choose their location for their trustee or otherwise game the distributions to avoid high tax states. And the implicit conclusion is that's not going to change the due process analysis. And that is just a function of federalism, where there are territorial limits to some degree, maybe not the same degree as in the 19th and early 20th centuries, but there are still meaningful territorial limits on state power. So in those two respects, there are some important takeaways from Kaestner, but all the different disclaimers and qualifications in the court's opinion do significantly narrow its implications.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.